It is good to be back with you this week. I enjoyed my week off a week ago. I appreciate those of you that prayed for me. It was a productive week, but it is good to be back among you this week as we come back now to our study through the Gospel of Mark. I wonder, have you ever encountered situations that left you confused? I expect most of us have a time or two. My son had one of those this week. My son Daniel in Germany, was traveling to Germany this week. He'll be there for about 3.5 weeks. He's working with our missionaries, the Matias, at their camp there on some various projects. And we had set his phone up so that he'd have an international dialing plan, so that he would have a phone for special circumstances in when he was in Germany. So the travel plans he had to fly to Frankfurt, and then he takes a train to Gotha, which is where Kevin Mattia, our missionary, was going to pick him up. So when he got on the train at Frankfurt, he used his phone and he called Kevin Mattia and told him he was on the train, everything's on schedule. A little while later, they had a little hiccup, so he was going to be about an hour late getting there with the train. So he called Mattia again to say, I'll be late, no problem there. Well, he gets to Gotha and gets off the train, and he's going to call the Kevin and say, I'm here, I have arrived, and his phone wouldn't work. He wasn't able to dial his phone. It kept saying, you're unable to use the network. He was able to reach out to me through Facebook and got a hold of me, and I got a hold of Verizon, and we're trying to figure out why won't his phone work, because here he is in Germany at a train station and no way to get where he needs to go. So Verizon agent was able to confirm, yes, his plan's all set up fine, and he was able to actually call me once he made an adjustment, and I was able to call him, but he still couldn't call Kevin Mattia. And I'm sure he was a little stressed. I know he was very confused at that point. Anyway, he was there, and a stranger came by, saw he was struggling with it, and stopped to help him, and said, oh, well, you're local now. You have to dial the number differently. And that little piece of data was all it took. He changed how he was dialing the number, and he got right through. Unfortunately, by that time, all he got was voicemail, he said, so it took a little while to hook up, but he still was able to dial. You know, sometimes the things we know are not enough. We can still be confused because of just a little bit of missing information. And when the things we know do not quite fit with the reality that we're facing, we become confused. You may recall that I told you in the last couple of weeks that from chapter 6, in chapter 6, they essentially wrapped up Jesus' main ministry around the Sea of Galilee. That the ministry they had for about a year and a half, he wrapped up at the end of chapter 6. And Mark is going to soon address Jesus' final trip as he journeys down to Jerusalem for his final week. But between that, Mark includes a few chapters to address some different items. If you remember back 2 weeks ago in chapter 7, Mark seemed to be intentionally showing us that Jesus' ministry went beyond just to the Jews as he traveled into a region of the Gentiles. His ministry included the Gentiles as well as the Jews. Well, today in our chapter, we're looking at chapter 8 that Pastor Ben read. And again, it seems like this chapter primarily takes place in Gentile regions, but that's not Mark's focus. He's shifting his focus to another one of those topics he just wants to round out before we move to that final week. This morning, we have a number of people that show up in our chapter. And pretty much every one of them will be confused by Jesus. Confused in one way or another. Yet as we begin to look at the events of this chapter, I want you to pay particular attention to where Mark places his focus. Mark focuses on the disciples. As we observe how he focuses on the disciples, we will be able to see the main idea for this chapter progressively unfold. The first part of the main idea comes into focus as we consider the first 21 verses. The first 21 verses actually contain three different events, but they all function together to build one base idea. The first event is this miracle that's recorded in the first 9 verses. As I mentioned, we're most likely still in Gentile regions because when we ended chapter 7, we were in the Gentile regions, and when Jesus and his disciples take the boat in verse 10, they land back in a Jewish region of Sea of Galilee. I've mentioned before that the Sea of Galilee kind of divides one side of it is Gentile lands, primarily the other side is Jewish lands. So they're probably still in Gentile area, but that's not Mark's main concern here. Mark focuses on the miracle. Once again, we find Jesus in a rather desolate area with a large crowd of people. People that are assembled there listening to his teaching. Apparently now they've been with Jesus for 3 days, and any food that they'd brought along had run out. They were quite hungry. I don't know how many of you have heard of the Babylon Bee. How many have heard of Babylon Bee? It's a website, a blog that's written that specializes in phony, humorous satire articles focused on church life. So it's always things about church life and written in satire. Last November, they had an article about how half of the church congregation died of starvation when the sermon went 15 minutes over the pastor's regular time. That's humorous because it's a little closer to home than we probably want to admit how we function. These people have been here for 3 days. They're truly hungry. They've been with him for the entire 3 days, and they are truly hungry. Jesus looks at them, and he feels compassion. You know, Mark doesn't tell us anything about what Jesus teaches, but he focuses on the compassion. Jesus taught for 3 days. I'm sure he covered a lot of topics, but Mark tells us about Jesus' compassion. Jesus mentions his concern to the disciples, and they respond essentially in the same way that they responded back in chapter 6 with the feeding of the 5,000. What do you want us to do about it? This time, though, at least they're a little bit ready when Jesus asked them, How many loaves of bread do we have? And they've taken inventory. We have 7. We know the answer. One would think that they would have anticipated what came next. But there's nothing in the text that gives us any indication that the disciples were anticipating the feeding. Jesus has the people sit down, and once again he miraculously feeds all of them, 4,000 this time. And when everyone is finished, they take up 7 large baskets. And there's a different word used here than the word we had for the baskets back in chapter 6. These are large baskets, same word that's used if you know about Paul when he's let down the wall outside Damascus. Paul's placed in a basket that uses his name. These are large baskets. There may even be more leftovers this time than there was last time. I don't know. Anyway, as soon as they're done eating, Jesus sends the people away, and immediately, there's that familiar word we have in this gospel, immediately in verse 10, Jesus and his disciples get in the boat, and they cross the sea. Now, we've moved through the miracle pretty quickly, but I want you to lock in on the fact that Jesus has once again demonstrated his divine power. In fact, the way that Mark words things in the original Greek in verse 4, there's an emphasis in the way he words bread and desolate place, where it seems like he's intentionally drawing a parallel between the way Jesus provides food now and the way God provided manna in the wilderness. Jesus' divine power has been displayed. Now, as soon as Jesus gets back into the Jewish region, he's immediately confronted by Pharisees again in verse 11, and they demand a sign from heaven. A sign from heaven. What they are asking for is a clear vindication of Jesus from God. That's what they mean by that. They want uncontroversial evidence that God approves of Jesus. They want this evidence before they'll accept Jesus. They ask for this, Mark says, to test him. Possibly they're hoping that Jesus will agree to take on some mighty deed and fail in the process. All the amazing miracles that Jesus has already performed apparently mean nothing to them. They want something stupendous. Raising a girl from the dead wasn't enough, I guess. The word that we have translated there in verse 12 as sighing deeply is only used in this place in the entire New Testament. It's one of those deep, deep emotional sighs. It shows that Jesus is moved with deep emotion as he emphatically denies their request. No. They rejected him. He will not bend to their will. So he abruptly departs again across the lake. Now, it really shouldn't be too surprising to us to see the Pharisees reject Jesus again. That's been their MO all along. Every time we meet the Pharisees, they reject him. But the disciples are certainly standing there watching this interaction. They should have been thinking, what do you mean you want a sign? Jesus has done everything that the Messiah was to do. Everything. You come up with a list that the Old Testament says of what the Messiah was to do and check them off. Jesus has done it. He is clearly the Son of God. Where's your faith? That's what the disciples should have been thinking. But observe what happens while they're again crossing the lake in a boat. Jesus and his disciples cross the lake a lot in a boat in the Gospel of Mark. There's a lot of boat rides. Once again, we're given a foreshadowing here of what's coming in verse 14 when Mark just happens to mention they forgot to take bread. They only have one loaf. Now, I've got to believe, using some sanctified imagination here, that Jesus is still rather emotional over this confrontation. This was deep emotion that verse 12 is bringing up, and he leaves right away. I get the feeling that the disciples maybe are just going to leave him alone. Give him a chance to relax. Give him some space. Give him some peace. The disciples, they're just sitting there pulling on their oars. They're going across the lake. Suddenly, Jesus yells, "Watch out!" I wonder if it's a bit like when Grace suddenly remembers something that she had been thinking of, and, "Oh no!" while I'm driving. And I'm immediately looking around, where's the car I'm about to hit? They're in the middle of the lake. What can they hit? Oh no! Jesus says, "Beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod." Huh? I envision the disciples pausing as they're rowing. Huh? What is he talking about? They go back to rowing, but there's a whispered conversation. What is he talking about? I don't know. He must know we forgot the bread. That's it. We had one thing to do and we messed it up again. Jesus hears the whispered conversation, and he walks them through the math lesson of the next several verses. Guys, I broke 5 loaves. I fed 5,000 people. How many baskets did you pick up? 12. I broke 7 loaves. I fed 4,000 people. How many baskets did you pick up? 7. All of you remember story problems, right, from math class? The implied question here would be then how many disciples can I feed with one loaf? You see, the point that Jesus is making is that in spite of all the time that they've spent with him, in spite of all the miracles that they've observed, in spite of all the teaching that they've heard, they still did not fundamentally get who he was. He says, "Do you not yet understand? Do you not yet understand?" That is a convicting statement. But it's also a hopeful statement. Not yet. Not yet is discouraging because it means that they are not where they should be. But not yet also implies that they may get there at some point. All is not hopeless. The disciples are left simply pondering this matter. Folks, this is where we need to start thinking about the main lesson for us today. We should be men and women of faith. Faith in Jesus. We probably know, or at least we've probably heard, that only through faith in Jesus can we have salvation. Saving faith only comes through faith in Jesus. Yet from the disciples, we must recognize that saving faith requires understanding. That is where we have to start. Saving faith requires understanding. We cannot have faith in what we do not understand. We certainly don't want to be like the Pharisees. The Pharisees have completely rejected Jesus. We don't want to be like them. But we also cannot be content to be like the disciples who do not yet understand. Such a position does not bring about saving faith. Saving faith requires understanding. We also need to realize that as we talk to others about Jesus, we have to remember this same point. We may talk to people who think they have accepted Jesus, but they have not really accepted him if they do not understand. Saving faith requires understanding. That's the base point to begin with this, to develop our idea today. Now let's move on to the next section and clarify this base idea a little bit. We need to look at verses 22 through 33 as they add some clarification to our base idea. Saving faith requires understanding, but we have to clarify that. Verse 22 actually begins a section now that runs all the way through chapter 10. Verses 22 through 26 record a miracle here where Jesus gives sight to a blind man. And then chapter 10 ends with Jesus giving sight to blind Bartimaeus. And these two miracles, this one here in verse 22 and the one at the end of chapter 10, they function like bookends around a section here where Jesus zeroes in on the disciples. The disciples become the focus of his ministry from now until Jesus arrives in Jerusalem for his final week. Now, that's just give you a bit of the larger framework that makes up the book here, but let's think about verses 22 through 33 specifically. The miracle of Jesus healing this blind man in Bethsaida is unique. This is the only two-stage miracle recorded. This blind man here is brought to Jesus, and Jesus spits on his eyes. I know, yuck, right? And I don't know why. But he spits on his eyes, and he lays his hands on him, and the guy's sight is partially restored, but it's still fuzzy. Jesus lays his hands on him a second time, and then his sight is fully restored. The question that we should be asking ourselves is why? Surely Jesus is not lacking in power or ability. Surely he could have healed the guy on his first attempt. Why the two-phased approach with this one miracle? Mark seems to want us to ask this question. The very next thing that Mark records is the question that Jesus poses to the disciples in verse 27. As this group walks towards Caesarea Philippi, the Caesarea Philippi is a city about 25 miles north of the Sea of Galilee, well into Gentile lands. And we're not told why they're going up there. We're just told that they're walking that direction. And while they're walking, Jesus asks, "Who do people say that I am?" And the disciples give them the answers that they're hearing from people. And these answers are very similar to what we saw back in chapter 6, verses 14 and 15, when Herod had heard about Jesus, and while people were saying, and Herod concluded that Jesus was John the Baptist, raised from the dead. Very similar answers are still going around, but then Jesus asks the ultimate penetrating question. Who do you say that I am? In the original, there is heavy emphasis on the you. The New International Version tries to bring out by translating, but as for you, who do you say? Peter, speaking for the group, gives this great answer that we have here in verse 29. You are the Christ. Bam! He nails the answer. Give that man a gold star. Mark an A+ on the top of his page. He gives the best answer possible. Isn't that the response we'd expect Jesus to give? This is the right answer. Peter gives here the textbook correct answer. Jesus is the promised Messiah of the Old Testament. That's what Christ means. He is the Christ. But look at verse 30. Instead of giving him the gold star, Jesus warns the disciple to tell no one this answer. In fact, the word that we have there for warned is a word that normally means to rebuke. The implication is that there would be something erroneous about telling this statement to others. Again, we're left with the second question, why? Why a two-phased healing? Why is the right answer to the most important question to be kept secret? Let's move into the next event. Jesus, for the first time, begins to teach the disciples about his coming death. The phrase in verse 31, he began to teach, tells us that this is something new. This is new information, new teaching. Jesus clearly teaches that his future contains a complete rejection by the Jewish leaders, a rejection that's going to culminate in his death. He also teaches that in 3 days, he will rise from the dead. In fact, he was stating this plainly, we're told. And Mark uses a word there that means speech that conceals nothing. So Peter's reaction here wasn't because he misunderstands Jesus. When Peter pulls Jesus aside and says, whoa, you can't speak like that, it's not because Peter misunderstood. He understood perfectly. But what he understood, Jesus is saying, was not at all what he and the other disciples wanted to hear. It wasn't to their liking. So Peter takes Jesus aside and rebukes him. Mark uses the exact same word in verse 32 for rebuke as he'd used for warn back in verse 30. That's the trouble with sometimes translating Greek into English. To get the idea, we have to change words, but Mark's tying this together for us. Clearly, Peter, again, is acting as the spokesman for the entire group, and he rebukes Jesus. Well, Jesus turns around, he looks at the group, and then he rebukes Peter. Again, the same word. He rebukes Peter, get behind me, Satan. Now, I don't think Jesus is implying that Peter is indwelt by Satan at the moment, nor do I think that Jesus was directly addressing Satan. Rather, I think he is telling Peter that he is acting like Satan. Just as Satan tried to tempt Jesus in the wilderness. Satan's temptation ultimately boiled down when he took Jesus in the wilderness with, Jesus, take a path to glory that's different from what God's will dictated. Take a path that avoids the cross. Now Peter is attempting Jesus in the same way. Peter is telling Jesus to take a path that goes around the cross. Peter is acting like Satan. And Jesus tells him to stop. He says, get out of my sight so that I can focus solely on God's interest without being distracted by all the humanistic interests that you and the other disciples have clouding your vision. And it's from this last exchange with Peter that I think we can put all the pieces of this section together. The twofold healing of the blind man serves as a picture of the process by which the disciples are gaining their spiritual sight. They're beginning to see, but they're not seeing clearly. Their spiritual eyes are still fuzzy. They rightly understand that Jesus is the Messiah, so they have some vision there. But they did not rightly comprehend what that meant. Their view of the Messiah was not God's view of the Messiah. Their view was fuzzy. It was not clear. Their expectation of the Messiah was different from God's. Remember, Jesus had been dealing with a lot of messianic expectations. People thought at that day that the Messiah, the promised Messiah of the Old Testament, was going to come and free them from Roman occupation and make Israel great again. So when the people started to think that Jesus was Messiah, they wanted to crown him king. And in a short time, when Jesus leads the disciples into Jerusalem to those cries of, Hosanna, Hosanna! Those cries are a cry because the people think that their king has arrived. Yes, Jesus truly is the king. He is King of Kings and Lord of Lords, but his purpose in his first coming was not to take his throne, it was to save his people. And to save his people, his death was necessary. The cross was a key component to his purpose for coming. And yet the disciples did not fully comprehend that. Their spiritual eyes, their spiritual vision was fuzzy. It was not complete. And that is a clarifying idea that we need to gain from this section here. Saving faith requires a complete understanding. Not just understanding, it must be a complete understanding. There are many, many people who have a fuzzy understanding of Jesus. And with that fuzzy understanding of Jesus, they've created some idea that they call faith. Just like the disciples created some idea of a Messiah. Yet anything short of a complete understanding cannot generate saving faith. An encounter with the true Jesus will simply leave the people confused because Jesus will not meet their expectations. Folks, we need to be aware of this reality. First of all, we dare not deceive ourselves into thinking that we have saving faith if our faith is not based on a complete understanding of Jesus. Now, by that, I don't mean that we need to know everything that there is to know. That's not what I mean by complete. But it means knowing the fullness of the gospel as revealed. We need to know that Jesus is the Son of God. We need to know that Jesus took on full humanity. We need to know that Jesus lived sinless. We need to know that he gave his life willingly as a substitute for us. And we need to completely know that we can do nothing to save ourselves. All we can do is bow on our face before him and accept Jesus. That's all we can do. We need a complete understanding. Completely understand that we are lost. Absolutely, completely sinful to our core. And it's only work of grace that can save us. We need to have a complete understanding, or else we will create some fuzzy vision of faith that is not saving. Secondly, we must be willing to lovingly confront others when they're confused because they lack a complete understanding. A confrontation with the real Jesus will leave people confused until they have an accurate understanding. So we need to share the details of the gospel. We need to insist on a complete understanding before we acknowledge a person as a believer. You know, just because a person calls himself a Christian does not mean that person has saving faith. We have to remember that saving faith requires a complete understanding. Now, in the final verses of our chapter, Mark brings together a collection of Jesus' sayings. And all of these teach what real discipleship is about. Jesus addresses not only the 12 disciples at the time, but also a crowd around him. I'm not sure where the crowd comes from. Mark just kind of skips over that, but we have a crowd here. And that means, though, the fact that there's this entire crowd with the disciple, that means that these teachings are for all who would follow Jesus. And also that the simple fact that these verses are placed immediately after Jesus was talking about his own suffering implies that his followers should expect to suffer as well. Of course, the idea of suffering is clearly conveyed in the very first statement that Jesus' followers must deny themselves and take up their cross. I know I've said this before, but I cannot stress enough how necessary it is that we strip from our minds the clean, sentimentalized idea that we have of a cross. We use the cross in a very sentimental fashion, and that is not the way we should think about it. A cross was not a symbol that you hung on the wall around your neck, or on the wall around your neck, whatever. I put those together. It's not that kind of a symbol in that day. The cross was an instrument of gruesome, painful death. It was bloody. It was horrible. It was torturous. Jesus' statement to deny themselves and take up the cross was a statement that says a follower must be willing to give up everything that's dear in life, even life itself, for his sake. Jesus' admonition here is an admonition to martyrdom, not to security. You know, part of our false Christianity is that we think Christianity is the way to become secure. It's the way of martyrdom, not security. Jesus builds this idea in the following verses. And again, it's a bit unfortunate that we cannot really translate the links that Jesus employs in verses 35 through 37. Jesus uses one key word throughout these three verses. But in verse 35, we have the word translated as life. And in verse 36 and 37, it's translated as soul. That's because in English we don't have a good word to use to bring it out for the different nuances of the phrase. But the word is a word that refers to the wholeness or the oneness of a person, his entire being. Maybe we could read these verses using the idea of complete being to just get Jesus' thought a little bit more clearly. For whoever wishes to save his complete being will lose it. But whoever loses his complete being for my sake and the gospel's sake will save it. For what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his complete being? For what will a man give in exchange for his complete being? Jesus' point is that the only way to really have a life that's worth living is to live in a manner that is completely committed to him. Complete dedication to the gospel. Complete dedication to God's will. Unless a person does that, no matter what he gains in this lifetime, he will have forfeited the only thing that ultimately makes life meaningful. In fact, the only way that one can have complete commitment to Jesus, we're told in the last verse, is to not be ashamed of him. Now, again, we have to put ourselves in the context of Jesus' original hearers and Mark's original readers. And in both of those ears, the idea would have been to not be ashamed would carry the idea of not denying Jesus, even in a time of persecution. They knew that persecution could be the result of not denying Jesus, of not being ashamed of him. To not be ashamed of him meant they could suffer personally, physically. And yet, Jesus holds out the idea that he is coming again. And the clear knowledge that Jesus is coming again, the next time coming in glory, that was to be enough to sustain them at every moment of trial. When the temptation comes to duck for cover and to hide, rather than to stand for the name of Jesus, they're to look to the future and hold on to that. They are to remain totally committed to him, even if it means suffering. And with that idea, we can finish the main idea for this entire chapter. Saving faith requires a complete understanding that results in total commitment. That's the expansion that we see here, that results in total commitment. How do you know if you have saving faith? How do you know if you have a complete understanding? Do you have a total commitment to Jesus? There's nothing other than a saving faith that develops a total commitment. Nothing else will produce it. A total commitment cannot be faked. You will not give up your life for something you are not totally committed to. Only saving faith that comes from a complete understanding is sufficient to bring that level of commitment. Only a complete understanding of who Jesus is, the Son of Man, the Son of God, the one who died on the cross for our sins, the one who rose again on the third day, the one who ascended back to heaven, the one who is coming again, and the one before whom we will stand and give an account. Only that will generate a complete, total commitment. That is the understanding that we need to have, and that is the result that we need to see. Do you have that kind of commitment? You know, I've observed many of you that are committed to various things. Commitments that you're willing to not be ashamed of. You'll even face ridicule. People will mock you for some of your commitments, and you're fine with that. You're committed to sports teams, even when they lose, even when they have no chance of winning. You'll proudly stand for those teams. You're committed to diets. You're committed to special projects. You're committed to political campaigns. And the list goes on and on of things I've observed in you and myself that we're committed to. Where does your commitment to Jesus land on the spectrum? Would your closest friends, would your family, those who know you best, would they say that you have a total commitment to Jesus? Saving faith requires a complete understanding that results in a total commitment. Life can result in confusion at times. I told you Daniel was confused trying to use his phone this week in Germany. Many of the people in our chapter this morning were confused by Jesus, the disciples most of all. Yet through Mark's record of their confusion, we've been able to learn our main idea. Saving faith requires a complete understanding that results in total commitment. Do you have a complete understanding of Jesus and his gospel? In other words, do you have saving faith? Do you have a total commitment to Jesus? We really can't have one without the other. Saving faith requires a complete understanding that results in a total commitment. Let's pray.